This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you heard just a bit about the accomplishments of today's guest, it would be easy to feel intimidated. As an astrophysicist, he's authored close to a dozen books, all first written in French, then translated into some 20 languages. His research led to the discovery of the youngest known galaxy in the universe. The nation of France recently awarded him the Legion of Honor. But it should be noted that many of this man's books are written for a lay audience. And in his work at the University of Virginia, he even teaches a course called Astronomy for Poets. One of his favorite topics, the connections between science and spirituality. How we've let 7 years get by since our last visit with him, I have no idea, but I suspect you will soon find yourself feeling as grateful as I do that we are once again meeting up with Dr. Trinh Tuan right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. And if you've got thoughts about astronomy, the Big Bang, the nature of the universe, or even connections between science and spirituality, we want to hear from you. We're coming to you today from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville. Trinh Xuan Tuan has been working in the field of astrophysics since the 1960s. He's been on the faculty of the University of Virginia's astronomy department since the mid-1970s. He's written numerous popular books on science, and it is a delight to have him back on the Insight airwaves. Dr. Tuan, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thank you for having me here. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, let's start with an easy one. What is physics and what is astrophysics?
Well, physics is the studies of laws that connect different phenomena. For instance, why is the sky blue? Why is this table solid? So for instance, we study the nature of atoms. For instance, why I can talk to you and the listener can listen to me. It's through so-called electromagnetic waves. So all those are so-called physics. And then astrophysics is the study of the universe by applying these physical laws. So in I have to say that there's two main theories born at the beginning of the 20th century that kind of subtend all of physics. One describes what is called the infinite large, that general relativity of Einstein theory. And the other one describe the infinitely small, so that the world of atoms, and that is called quantum mechanics. So these two stand as the two pillars of physics, and in fact, to understand the universe, the astrophysicists, in fact, have to have knowledge of these two physical theory to try to understand the phenomena he's observing in the sky.
This table that you just pointed to a moment ago, why is it solid?
It is solid because it's composed of atom. Atom is nearly completely empty. In fact, the nucleus occupy a very, very tiny fraction, 1 billionth or something like that, of the whole atom. So it's completely empty, in fact. And we don't see it because we don't see on the scale of atom. But it's solid because there are electromagnetic forces. So there's electrons that bind with each other, and then, they're bound together, and so that's why we cannot, the electromagnetic forces make that we cannot put our hand through it. We cannot go through walls because matter is solid.
Even though it's 99.999% empty space.
Exactly. So that is the so-called electromagnetic forces.
Is it in part because the what little bit is solid is moving so fast?
No. It's just that the forces, bind this thing together. And so, this electromagnetic force. So there's four fundamental forces in nature. Okay, there's a gravity, which is make it, for instance, we're not floating in the air because the gravity is attracting it toward the center of the Earth. And then there's the two nuclear forces. So the so-called strong forces that bind proton and neutron together to the nucleus, which form a tiny fraction of the volume of the nucleus and of the atom, like I just said. And then there's the fourth force, and is the electromagnetic forces. So which is bind electron together. So the atoms form molecule, molecules form chains of molecule, and then, you know, the DNA in our body, and then the neuron in our brain. You know, all this, all what we see is a consequence of four forces acting in nature.
I asked you this question 7 years ago. You know, it was actually May of 2007.
Incredible. We Time flies, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't believe it's been so long. But let me ask it again, because there may be some people listening today who missed that show seven years ago.
Okay.
It's about your name. You were born in Vietnam.
Correct.
And so your name, Trinh Tuan.
Yes.
For many Americans, as we structure names here, would think of Trinh as a first name.
Yes.
But in Vietnamese, it's what Americans would think of as a last name.
Exactly, exactly. The order is reversed in Vietnamese.
So people who are friends, and you've been kind enough to call me friend and tell me that I can call you by your first name, would call you Tuan.
Exactly.
But I understand some of your students call you Dr. Tuan, which would be sort of like people calling me Dr. Tom.
Exactly, exactly. Because, you know, that's the custom in Vietnam also. You see, even with title and so on, people still call a person by their surname. So it's like, you know, President Chu or President Diem, for instance, you know, you would say President Barack in the U.S., you see, but that's a custom. You know, there's nothing deep to it. It's just a custom. We inverse the order. And in fact, the Chinese do also. But and when people, some student Chinese or Asian or even Vietnamese, some of my compatriots, move or immigrate over here, they change the order of their name. But to me, it was always very strange to see the name that I was given at birth change the order. And so I kept it that way. And so I signed all my article and my books Trinh Tuan. But Tuan is the equivalent of your first name.
Well, your books. There are at least 10 of them now, aren't
Yes.
there? And many of them touch on great philosophical questions, connections that you see between science and spirituality. Well, why is that?
Well, I think that man, to be whole, has to look at things from different points of view. I mean, I agree that science is a very powerful method to look at reality. We have, you know, scientists have invented instrument, you know, a microscope to look at the infinitely small, and telescope to look at the infinitely large, things that escape completely the normal human being, you know, that do not have access to this telescope. And so, so science is very powerful. It has what is called a scientific method. You know, you make observation, you build a theory, and then you check with your observation whether that theory works or not. But, you know, I think that's not the only means of looking at reality. I think that, all the windows, like poetry, like art, like spirituality, have also a role to play. I think that the great spiritual leaders, Buddha 2,500 years ago, or Jesus Christ 2,000 years ago, you know, certainly saw some aspect of reality that they can communicate and teach us. So I think that, you know, all these windows are complementary. They form a whole, and man is whole. You know, you cannot compartmentalize a human being, I think. You know, I mean, he's curious, and hence he asks scientific question, but also he has a spiritual needs, a spiritual being, and so he wonders, for instance, you know, what is afterlife, when his mother and father die, you know, whether you know that's the complete end, or whether there's a spirit left, even though the material body is not there anymore. I mean, things like that, you know, preoccupy all of humanity. And of course, poets also have tried to answer those questions, and great artists also. They try to make us, by doing great painting, great sculpture, to look at reality in a different manner.
Your family, growing up in Vietnam, were all Buddhists.
Yes.
Is Buddhism still important to you today?
Yes, yes, it's very much so. And of course, it's 90% of the population of Vietnam was raised in traditional Buddhist. So Buddhism, I grew up with Buddhism, but I must say that it was more a practice. You know, you go to pagoda and maybe learn technical meditation. But I didn't understand really the deep philosophy of it. I think that that realization came only when I started to discuss these issues with a French Buddhist monk who was an ancient scientist called Mathieu Ricard. From this discussion between science and spiritual aspect of reality came out a book which is called in English, The Quantum of the Lotus. So I think that, you know, from then on, I really look at it much more deeply. But, you know, I always practice it, of course.
Is there something about Buddhism, in your view, Dr. Tuan, that leads to a sense that there are great similarities between science and spirituality?
Well, I think that that was one of the questions I asked myself when I started this book with on the Quantum and the Lotus. You know, certainly, one of the aims of Buddhism, of course, is what is called a rich enlightenment. And what is enlightenment in Buddhism? It's access to ultimate truth, ultimate reality, you see. And so Buddha certainly had a certain view of reality when he reached enlightenment 2,500 years ago. And so I was greatly comforted to see that some of the views that he expressed then, how he described the world, very much in agreement, you know, and do not contradict at all the finding of modern science. I'll give you some example.
Oh, please do.
So, for instance, there are three basic tenets of Buddhism. You know, one is called the so-called the interdependence of things. You know, things are always related to each other. You cannot never describe some things as existing in isolation from all the other things. For instance, you know, I mean, I look at this table. I mean, this table is not by itself. I mean, you have to look at the wood that make it, the tree from the wood came from, the carpenter that made it. So, you know, there's a whole chain of interdependence. But it more deeply, of course, the interdependence of phenomena and of human of beings as well. So we are connected to the cosmos. And, of course, that's the whole theme of modern astrophysics. Because, you know, since the 1950s or so, we know now, except for hydrogen and helium were two elements that were made in the Big Bang, the first 3 minutes of the universe. But all the other elements in the chemical table, the so-called Mendeleev periodic table that we all learned in high school, were made in stars. So we in some sense, we are the children of stars. We see.
Yeah, I've heard you say before that we are all stardust.
Exactly.
And you're not just being a poet when you say that.
No. This is really a scientific statement. Yes, yes. So, you know, except for hydrogen and helium, all the other elements, you know, like the silver of my watch, for instance, the gold of my ring, the carbon atom in my body, they were all made by stars. So without the star, we'll not be here at all. So that's in the deepest sense, the interdependence of all human beings. And so in that sense, then we are interdependent of all other human beings. And here you see Buddhism introduces the idea of compassion because of that, because we are all related to each other. We all share the same cosmic genealogy. So the happiness of others our happiness depend on the happiness of others.
Hold that thought, please, because we're going to hit the break here in just a moment. And for anybody who's just tuned in, I wanted to, ask you, what is science? What is religion? What is philosophy? Our guest, astrophysicist Trinh Tuan, has written extensively on these questions, and our conversation is going to continue in just a bit more than 1 minute. All of his books were first written in French, then translated into as many as 20 different languages. Among those available in English, The Secret Melody, Birth of the Universe, Chaos and Harmony, and The Quantum and the Lotus, were talking about that a few moments ago. It's co-authored with a Buddhist monk, and it looks at the similarities and dissimilarities in how Buddhism and science view the nature of reality. Astrophysicist Trinh Tuan is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So you were saying that there are three basic tenets, Tuan, of Buddhism.
Yes.
And you see all three of those as being similar to some of the tenets of science.
Yes.
Continue with that.
Yes. So the second one, I would say, is the notion of impermanence. So nothing is still, nothing is, everything evolves in the universe. You see, that was not the view in Western philosophy. Because, for instance, Aristotle thought that changes happen only on the earth. But the heaven was the abode of God. And God being perfect, how can you change something which is already perfect? So it should be still and not evolving at all. So, of course, all modern science has completely changed that view, and certainly the science of the 20th and now the 21st century. So, for instance, in the universe, you see the universe is constantly evolving. It has a history now. It has a beginning called the Big Bang, of a very tiny state, very hot, very dense. Then was a huge expansion of space. And then so now that gave birth to the universe 14, and it has been around 14 billion years. So not only is the universe evolved, but everything has evolved. You see, nothing can be still, nothing can be unchanging. So for instance, the star, like you and me, they are born, they live, and they die. Not on cycle of 100 years like a human being, but on cycle of millions of years and even billions of years. For instance, the sun, for instance, you see, our star was born 4.5 billion years ago, and it will live another 4.5 billion years. So it will have a total lifetime of 9 billion years. But, in the end, when it runs out of hydrogen fuel, it will collapse to what is called a white dwarf, which is the whole volume of the sun, the whole mass of the sun compressing to the volume of the earth, for instance. And so, but all the stars that are more massive than the sun will, either explode in a supernova and the core will collapse to become what is called a neutron star, a black hole. Okay, so those are the finding of modern astrophysics. Everything changes. So, and that's not only true of the heavens, but also true on Earth. I mean, here on Earth, we know that all human being changes, right? Evolve. Even Darwin theory, for instance. People thought that before that we were born from Adam and Eve, but well, we know now we all have a ancestor, a primitive cell somewhere in the primordial ocean, I don't know, 3.8 billion years ago or something like that, and that evolved into fishes and various things.
So everything is impermanent.
Everything is impermanent.
And Buddhism.
Exactly.
Agree on
exactly.
That.
Exactly. And then
everything's interdependent.
Interdependent. And then the third tenet is that the fact that, and that's a direct consequence of the interdependent things, is that nothing, things do not exist by themselves. They don't have an intrinsic existence. It's called a vacuity. Emptiness is a concept philosophically maybe a bit hard to understand, because we think that things have a tangible existence, we can touch them and so on, but in fact they do not exist by themselves. So that's the concept of so-called vacuity, emptiness. So and that's true also, and that you have to get into quantum mechanics, is the science of the infinitely small. For instance, light, for instance, people have discovered, to the great astonishment of physicists, actually, that light can have two natures. Sometimes it can be particle, but sometimes it can be wavy. So depending on circumstances. So something which can be two things at the same time, what can it be? So it does not have intrinsic existence. In fact, its existence depends on the observer. See, if you activate your apparatus of measurement, then light become particle. You can see them as what is called a photon, a particle of light. But if you do not activate your apparatus of measurement, then you can describe it only under a wavy structure. It has, and that's a wave of probability. So a probability that an electron can be here or there, but you never can tell exactly where it is. So it's very interesting and very, very disturbing in some sense, because reality is not as solid as we think it is. And in fact, that's the concept of vacuity of Buddhism as well.
So the three tenets of Buddhism that you see as also being three tenets of science.
Yes.
Interdependence.
Impermanence and then vacuity. Yeah. Yeah. I think that that describes, a lot of what's going on in the universe. Of course, science has a different language, you know. It doesn't say the same thing. But impermanence, we would call it evolution. The evolution of universe, or the evolution theory of Darwin, right? We don't call it the impermanence theory, but that's, I think that reflects exactly the same idea.
Okay, so let me put you on the spot at least once, Tuan. By the way, for anybody who's just tuned in, astrophysicist from the University of Virginia and recent French Legion of Honor winner, Trinh Tuan, is our guest. You mentioned several minutes ago that people wonder about the afterlife. What do you believe about the afterlife, and is there any scientific basis for believing in an afterlife?
Well, I think that it's hard to have scientific evidence. I think that we're going beyond the realm of science. Now, of course, science maybe one day, but for the moment, you know, there's some limit to it, and you know, we don't have ways of exploring that. I mean, for instance, so I can only talking about my belief as a Buddhist only, not as a scientist. Okay, so as you know, in Buddhism, we think there's a cycle of life and death. So, because enlightenment is such a difficult process to access, you know, to access ultimate truths, we need many lives, not only one life. So we believe that after this one life, then maybe the flow of consciousness, your flow of consciousness, will be reincarnated into another material support. You know, it could be another human being. You know, very, very advanced human being. So, or if you had a bad karma being the sum of all the bad and good actions that you made in your life. So, if you have a bad karma, that means you have a deficit of positive action and a lot of bad action that you can come back, you know, not maybe as a dog or cat, which would be harder than to retake the path toward enlightenment. So that's a belief. It's we cannot demonstrate that. Now people have some people. In fact, I used to talk once to Dr. Ian Stevenson, who was a researcher at UVA, in fact, and he tried to interview people, children, that seem to remember things from the past. And but again, it's very, very tough to have solid scientific evidence for all this. But to me, it's always wonder. I'm always wondering, for instance, you know, we all know the 14th Dalai Lama, which is the present Dalai Lama, you know, and he said, you know, I don't know whether you had the occasion to meet him, but, you know, when you are in his presence, he radiates goodness and compassion and a lot of wisdom, you know, in whenever he talks. So, and you know, how was he found? Well, you know, one of the after the death of the 13th Dalai Lama, one of the notable in Lhasa, which is the palace in the Tibetan palace where the Dalai Lama resides, had a dream saying that you know in the Dalai Lama soul has been reincarnated into this child in an obscure village in Tibet somewhere. And so they had an expedition. They went and talked to this child, and you know, he seemed to recognize all the things that belong to the 13th Dalai Lama. You know, all the objects. And then he seemed to recognize also his friends as well. So how can this child know all this correctly? Also, so anyway, the Tibetan then brought back this child to Lhasa and then trained him. And, well, he became the leader that we all know today, you know, Nobel Prize, Peace Prize winner and so on, a man of great wisdom and goodness. And so if it's completely random, if it has no truth whatsoever idea that, you know, the spirit of the previous Dalai Lama reincarnated into the body of this child, how can, you know, from an obscure village, people can pluck out, you know, such a human being with such extraordinary qualities? I always wonder. Of course, you know, as a scientist, I say there's no evidence whatsoever, scientific evidence, of reincarnation, the afterlife, and so on.
I'm so curious that you say that. Because you just mentioned, I think you were talking about the work of Jim Tucker, who is a psychiatrist.
That's right. Jim Tucker, I think, took over from the work of Ian Stevenson that I mentioned before.
And both Dr. Stevenson, who is now deceased,
yes,
and Dr. Tucker, who are part of the University of Virginia's Division of Perceptual Studies. Dr. Tucker has been a guest on this show.
Okay.
And they traveled the world and found children who spoke of memories of past lives and were able to verify at times that they found children who had no way of knowing about a life from 40 or 50 years ago or more. And they went and found people who knew that person. Much of this work started in India, but there also have been some examples in the U.S. and other places in the world. And the stories that the child told were right on target with the historical facts. And there were even a few instances where children bore scars or birthmarks that were precisely the same, according to Dr. Stevenson and Dr. Tucker, as the person that they claimed to have had the life of. In other words, the person who existed or died some decades before. It seems to me that in many areas of science, that would be considered pretty good evidence. But when you're talking about anything that borders on spirituality or metaphysics, I wonder if scientists like yourself are just saying, no, that really can't be considered.
No, I didn't say it's can you consider, but, you know, it's less convincing, let's say, than doing an experiment, you know, in a laboratory, you know, finding a particle or measuring the properties of a star or recession velocity, the Hubble the expansion of the universe. It's not a precise measurement in some sense. And you see, one always can wonder also these people may have. You know, I don't know whether the thing that I don't know, you know, whether there were samples that were, you know, people that a test sample in some sense, you know, to compare with the one that they believe that were reincarnated. But, you know, a lot of other children do not have that. So you mentioned we focus only the one that we find it to be, you know, to prove your theory. So, I mean, there could be bias and things like that. I mean, that has been, you know, some of the criticism in the past of this kind of work.
Tom, that you find this in your own work, though. Based on what I've heard you say in the past when we've chatted, you had to be careful early in your career to talk about what you saw as connections between science and spirituality because you knew that you'd run into a lot of skepticism.
Yes,
isn't there sort of an automatic predisposition in some areas of science, at least, to think that people like Dr. Tucker or the other people who work at the Division of Perceptual Studies are sort of out in la-la land, that they're not real scientists because that topic isn't worthy of science?
Yeah, it's the it's not only the topic, but I think the method. You see, I mean, the thing is that you're talking to a physical scientist now. Now we have very precise experiment. You know, we do very precise observations. And then also the other thing that is very important is that whatever one group finds, you know, it has to be confirmed independently, completely by a different group. And, you know, whenever it's a very, very important result, it has to be checked, you know, tens of times even. So the thing is that, you know, again, you know, that's be nice to have different groups doing this work and finding things independently, the same result. That also, you know, it's hard to in science just to believe in one observation, one experiment, especially when it, you know, confront a very, very fundamental question. Right. So it's you know, I must say that I'm not familiar with so much the psychology technique and so on. It's not a hard science, as you know. It's not physics or astrophysics, the subject we started out with.
But there are people in your world, in the world of physics, who sort of groan when somebody brings up the question, is there a connection between science and spirituality?
Yes. You see, I'm very open-minded for that point of view, but I know that some of my colleagues would not even consider that there should be a dialogue between science and spirituality.
So why do you think that is?
Again, I think that, you know, some people think that that religion do not bring anything to humanity, which is, I think, completely wrong. I mean, I think that 98% of the people, you know, have spiritual questions. Even the atheists, you know, they always wonder about things. You know, I mean, they not believe in a certain god or a certain deity, but they ask themselves a spiritual question. So, but you know, there's some scientists think that, you know, this I think it's a rather arrogant attitude myself, that science is the only way to look at reality. Scientific method is the only way to investigate. So a subject that does not fulfill the requirement, the hard requirement of physical science experiment, cannot be called a science.
Trinh Xuan Tuan, longtime professor of astronomy at the University of Virginia and recent winner of France's Legion of Honor Award, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham, and we're going to continue in just a bit more than 1 minute. This is Virginia Insight. World-renowned astronomer Trinh Tuan is our guest. Trinh Xuan Tuan was born in Hanoi 6 years before Vietnam was divided into North and South. As a young child, he moved to what would become South Vietnam, where his father would become the Vietnamese equivalent of a justice of the Supreme Court. After school in France and Switzerland, Tuan moved to California to study at the place that at the time was home to the world's largest observatory, Caltech. And there he began his love affair with astronomy. After a doctorate at Princeton, Tuan joined the faculty at the University of Virginia, where he has been researching and teaching astrophysics for close to 40 years now. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. What's the question I have not asked you yet that if I was a good scientist, Tuan, I would have thought to ask?
Well, how about the fine-tuning of the universe?
Oh, good. So, what is the fine-tuning of the universe, Tuan?
Well, you know, I mean, it's people have discovered that the universe has been extreme fine-tuned in an extreme fashion for life and consciousness to emerge. Let me explain. See, we talked before about us being all stardust.
So I love that idea.
Yes.
That I'm, yeah, that I'm stardust.
Yes, but that's a correct idea. It's true. And so the amazing thing is that, you see, if we change something of the physical law or the initial condition just a tiny bit, then the universe would not have made star. And without stars, of course, we'll not have heavy elements, heavier than hydrogen and helium, and then we'll not be here to talk about it. So, and the fine-tuning is extremely great. It's very extremely precise. I mean, for instance, for the initial density of the universe, for instance, the density is just the amount of matter, the mass of the universe divided by its volume, essentially. And so you have to fine-tune it to something like the 40th decimal point. So that means if you have, you know, a number, and the 40 decimal point, you change one number at the 40th place, and then everything changes. The star do not form, and without star, there'll be no heavy elements, and no heavy element will not be here to talk about.
So some aspects of science believe that that kind of fine-tuning has happened completely by accident.
Well, I mean, some people do that, and especially, of course, the scientists that do not like the idea of any spirituality. So, for instance, that I cannot rule out. Of course, you know, if we have an infinity of universe, you see, and what's called a multiverse, that's a notion that has become very, very fashionable in cosmology in the last, I would say, 10 years or so. So we are not the only universe, but we are one universe among many other bubble universe in a meta-universe. So each of those universe would have a different combination of physical constants. So this physical constant are a number, its nature, that regulate the world as we know it. For instance,
so if you have an infinite number of universes, then
right,
you would have to have one
where by
these
chance
things happen by
chance.
Okay.
And
I want to ask you more about
the combination came out. It's like, you know, if you have you buy all the tickets of lottery somewhere, it has to be the winning
what
number,
a great
right?
Example. Yeah. We are starting to get some calls now. So let Rod's been holding on the line in Verona for a bit. Rod, thank you for patiently waiting. Your question or comment for Dr. Trinh Tuan, please.
Yes. My question is, this doctor has such a great wealth of knowledge, and I appreciate him sharing with it. It must be amazing to sit there and pick his brain over these things. But the whole concept, I want to kind of what his theory is of the black hole, and does another universe actually exist on the other side of it, and all those things. Take the answer off the air, I guess.
Oh, Rod, yes. Thanks so much. So if we could survive going through a black hole?
Right. That has been looked at scientifically.
Wow.
Again, you see, this is actually beyond a bit what our present knowledge. As I told you, there's two distinct theories now called the gravity is described by general relativity, and then the infinitely small is described by quantum mechanics. So black hole has both huge gravity, and of course, when you collapse into a black hole, it has very, very small size. So you have to to unify the two in a theory, what's called quantum gravity. Unfortunately, we haven't had, I mean, people are working very, very hard on that, but we haven't solved the problem yet. And so the quantum gravity is not, theory is not established yet. So all I can say now, it's what's based in general relativity. And so, you know, some people have constructed from general relativity the passage, which is tiny, is 10^-33 centimeter. You know, it's billions and billions and billions of time less smaller than an atom. And so this passage, so somehow you have to squeeze through that passage, 10^-33, and maybe you can emerge into what is called a white hole. So where matter emerges. So there's a wormhole connecting a black hole to a white hole. Now, so whether when you fall into a black hole, whether you can survive is another question, because tidal forces, you rip you apart. And then whether you can squeeze through this tiny passage, the wormhole, is another question. And then, you know, it does not open very much, very long. I think it can be open only on what is called a Planck time scale, 10 to minus 43 seconds. So there's a lot of problem with this idea of traveling from by falling to a black hole and emerging in another place in the universe into a white hole. So until we have a theory of quantum gravity, I think that all this is going to be science fiction and speculation.
Rod, thanks so much for your question. Trinh Xuan Tuan, longtime professor of astronomy at the University of Virginia and recent winner of France's Legion of Honor Award, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. What was it like to win the Legion of Honor?
Well, I was very, very proud of that. I went to French school when I was growing up in Vietnam. In fact, from the maternal school, you know, elementary school up until the end of high school, which is the French called baccalauréat. So we had to go through that. And I always, very early on, had a love for the French language and French culture. So when I first started then to think about writing my first book, it was natural that I use French as a language because I think that I grew up with it and I love the language. And you see, I don't think I could write as well either in English. I mean, I would if I can write like Shakespeare, of course, but I don't have the vocabulary clearly. I came here, in this country to attend Caltech, like you said before, and at 19 years old only. So I acquire English as a scientific language. So I write all my scientific papers in English. But
all of your books are written first in French translated.
Translated
and actually,
in
some
English.
Of them are not yet available in English.
Yeah, exactly.
I've heard people call you the Carl Sagan of France, or at least the people of France view you as their Carl Sagan.
Yes, well, it's a very great honor to be compared to Carl Sagan. I really have a great admiration for that scientist that really opened up, in fact, the cosmos. I mean, he had a television show that was watched by millions of people called Cosmos, in fact, which is being reprised now here.
Mm-hmm.
I did my best, and you know, it struck a chord in France and in French countries because. I've been invited also to Belgium, Switzerland, Morocco, Quebec. You know, all the people who speak French and read French. So it's a language where I feel the music and the poetry of it. And I think that to write a book, my books should not be only just to communicate scientific fact. I think it has to have the music and the poetry as well.
Your biography is just so inspiring, Tuan.
Thank you.
I mean, you grew up in a war-torn country. Your father actually ended up in a re-education camp after
yes.
you had already left Vietnam. And
it was a
the
great
North
personal
Vietnamese
tragedy. Yeah.
Had taken over South Vietnam.
Yes.
You had escaped to Europe by then. You come to America in your late teens. You fall
exactly.
in love with science. Your books are published in as many as 20 languages around the world. This most recent honor from France is one of many, many awards that you've won for your scientific work around the world. I'm curious if you sometimes look at what's happening in the U.S. today. And I think it's fair to say that the struggle that we are in to get young people interested and enthused about science, and you've become enthused about science in such an early age through such hardship and have carried it to such levels in your career. Do you have thoughts about what could be done to get more young people enthused about science?
Well, I think that the kind of show that you're doing now, you know, when we talk about science, and then, of course, scientists do things. We have an open house at McCombich Observatory, which is the small telescope of UVA, And, you know, it's open to the public.
But do you think
every two Friday?
Do you have any empathy with the idea that some people age 8, 10, 14 are just kind of scared of science, that they don't want to put their toe too far into the water because they think they're just not going to be any good at it?
That's true, and that's unfortunate. You know, it's that's true that, you know, unfortunately, the language of nature is mathematics. And so a lot of people maybe, you know, already had a scare of mathematics. And then you know, by reflection then, they are scared also of the whole of science, which should not be the case. I mean, you know, you can still have a very, very... you should be interested in science because it illuminates the world around us. And
so you've taught a course for many years now at the University of Virginia, in
yes.
addition to all the other research you do and all the other courses you do for science majors. You've taught a course for non-science majors called Astronomy for Poets.
Yes.
In all those years of teaching people who need to take a science course but are a little scared of the idea, have you come to any conclusions about people who end up in that course or what it takes to whet their interest in science?
Well, I think that, you know, basically, suddenly everybody who took that course were interested in the cosmos to start with. I think there's an innate connection between us and the cosmos. And I think that I am, fortunately, in a science that is very easy to communicate to the general public because everybody can just look up at the blue sky, look at the sun, look at the moon, and look at the stars and be transported by it and appreciate the vastness of space. So it's already a natural interest, and you know, my task there is just trying to make them less afraid, in fact, of this mathematical aspect of science. But, you know, emphasize more about the philosophical and maybe the spiritual aspect of certain of the questions that science asks also. So, you know, I try to give them that sense, and I hope that's what remain with them when they go on with their lives and go out, because they will not become a scientist nor a professional astronomer. That's obvious.
It sounds like what you're saying is that maybe if we encouraged more people to look up at the stars,
yes,
and imagine what's up there throughout the cosmos,
yes,
that then we might get them willing to learn a bit more math and investigate science a little further.
I think so. Certainly all the students who take my courses were first fascinated by the cosmos.
Okay, so we got 30 seconds left. What's the big question in your mind in science that you most want to see answered?
Well, in my field, 95% of the content of the universe is dark. So there's something like 25%, 29% of the content, which is called so-called dark matter, and then 70% of called dark energy, which is responsible for the expansion of the universe. And none of us has any idea what this could be like.
So dark matter and dark energy is what you'd really love for us to understand.
Exactly.
Our guest has been astrophysicist, University of Virginia professor of astronomy, and author of numerous popular books on the nature and philosophies of science, Trinh Xuan Tuan. Tuan, it's such a delight getting to spend time with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
Recordings of previous Virginia Insight broadcasts are available on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. When you get to the page for today's broadcast, you'll find links to more information about Dr. Tuan and the work he is doing. Virginia Insight's executive producer, Matt Bingay, associate producers, Bob Levicky, Terry Ward, and Dan Easley. And we had a whole bunch of extra help today from the folks at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. Have a great day.